Hello, and welcome to tonight's teleseminar by MomsFightingAutism.com. Our topic today is Autism, Food Aversions, and Eating Challenges, Effective Answers That Help. Our guest this evening is Dr. Lori Ernstberger. Dr. Ernstberger is from Henderson, Nevada, where she is the owner of Autism and Behavioral Consulting. Lori received her doctorate in special education from Indiana University. She has over 23 years of experience working in the public schools as a classroom teacher, an administrator, and a behavioral consultant. Dr. Ernstberger currently provides staff development and conference workshops to school district personnel and parents. Her workshops cover the following topics: managing problem behaviors, implementing effective instructional methods, designing appropriate and functional data collection methods for the classroom, practical strategies for working with individuals with Asperger syndrome, and how to get your kids to eat. Dr. Ernstberger is the author of three different books. One of them is Keys to Success for Teaching Students with Autism. Another one is Just Take a Bite, Easy Effective Answers to Food Aversions and Eating Challenges. And her new book is Girls Under the Umbrella of Autism Spectrum Disorders, which is published by Autism Asperger Publishing Company. Now, my name is Chantal Cecile Kira. I'll be moderating this teleseminar, and I'm the author of Autism Life Skills, Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum, and Autism Spectrum Disorders. Good evening, Dr. Lori.
Good evening. It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here at the teleseminar. I know that I had the pleasure of having you on my radio show a while back when your book had just come out, the Just Take a Bite, Easy Effective Answers to Food Aversions and Eating Challenges, and I had invited you because I had read this book and I thought how practical it was for parents and how helpful, because we all know how many people on the spectrum do have eating challenges. Would you like to talk a little bit to us about your book?
I would. I'd like to just let everybody know, first of all, how it came about to be. Many families, as I would travel around the country, would ask me specific questions about, they would have a child on the spectrum that wasn't eating, they were very picky, they had a lot of sensory issues around food, a lot of oral motor delays around chewing and swallowing. And so I got quite a few questions about what do I do. And so I started looking into the research about what was available to families who had children with developmental delays, and there really just wasn't much available to not only parents, but also to educators. So I looked to see what was available in a broader sense, not just for kids with developmental delays, and I found the work of Suzanne Evans Morris, and I want parents to be familiar with Suzanne's work, because she's one of the leading experts in the field of eating challenges, oral motor delays. She's a speech and language pathologist and is really an expert in all fields of eating issues, everything from chewing and swallowing, as I mentioned, sensory. But she works with children all across, not only just with developmental delays, but typical developing children and children with severe health issues. And so I was trained by Suzanne several years back, and then decided to write the book based on the training with Suzanne and also with an occupational therapist, which I think as parents, that's a topic we're going to cover today, finding the right OT, because I was fortunate enough to have a colleague here in Las Vegas where I live, and her name is Tanya Stegen Hansen. She was a great asset and highly trained in working with children with developmental delays and eating issues. So we decided to get together and write a book that would be something that a parent or a teacher could pick up and quickly try to find some strategies that they could implement both in the home and school. So that was really where it all started. We got the training. I looked at the research that was available out there and tried to put it in a format so parents could look at if they thought it was a sensory-based issues. There's a whole chapter on sensory issues and what to do. Same with oral motor delays. You know, many of us feel that eating is such a simple task. We just put the food in our mouth and chew and swallow. But eating is very complicated. It involves every one of our systems, from our skeletal to our respiratory system, our digestive system, the muscles. And if they're all not working in coordination, we're going to have problems. So that's where the book came out of. Since then, I've worked directly then with a lot of families, again, across the United States, and have developed eating programs to help with families. So that's a little bit about the book, and I thought maybe we could answer some of the questions that came out from your emails.
Right. I had one question, though, that I wanted to ask because I think I remember from your book that you actually talk about how you can tell if certain eating behaviors or challenges are either from a sensory point of view or if they are from a motor point of view, because there are different reasons why people have eating challenges. Is that correct?
And that's right. And that's why, you know, when we look at the oral motor component, there are certainly different tests that can be done through a highly trained OT and speech. Parents probably are not going to be able to do that on their own. We give them some red flags, like if there's drooling or if the child is pocketing a lot of food. You know how they'll squirrel food away in their cheeks. If they're gagging on food, if they're not able to maintain chewing for long periods of time, those are red flags that I would then recommend you take your child to a trained OT in speech, because they can then do those assessment tools to determine if it's an oral motor delay or is it sensory-based. And sometimes it's both. Sometimes you have a child who has some oral motor delays. And again, the oral motor, it may be a child who speaks very well. It's not that they don't have language or communication. They can speak, but that doesn't always mean that you can chew and swallow your food adequately. So there are some checklists in the book for parents to look at red flags, but it would require somebody with a little higher trained eye to look at that assessment to determine where are the delays in oral motor.
That's very helpful, Dr. Lori. I did want to mention before you start answering many of the questions that have been sent to us, because there are quite a few. This has really been a hot topic, as I can tell from the responses of the numbers of questions that have been sent in. But I feel compelled to explain to people who may be listening who have sent in some questions that Dr. Lori is not a medical doctor, and so she's unable to answer or respond to the questions that have to do with MRI exams and medical side effects and things that you really need to speak to a medical professional about. But there's a lot of information that Dr. Lori can help us with, so I'm going to start right now with a couple of questions. This one comes from Kansas Walton, Beach Island. I have a 4-year-old son who has become a very picky eater. We started to do GSCF diet 3 weeks ago, and he has not tried anything new. How do I get him to try something without him throwing it back at me?
Okay, that's a loaded question. I know it seems kind of straightforward, but let me pick that apart just a little bit. First of all, I need to state very clearly for everybody listening my position on the gluten and casein-free diet. I, as a professional, as an educator, feel strongly that we have to look at evidence-based methods. I'm always looking at the science. I want to see where is the proof to show. Is this an effective strategy? Is this something as an alternative treatment that as a parent or as a educator should we be implementing? And from my perspective and from the research that I keep up with on a daily basis, there is no specific scientific evidence to support a gluten and casein-free diet for kids on the autism spectrum. Now, having said that, if a parent feel strongly that for whatever reason, maybe they've worked with their pediatrician, and yes, the pediatrician has determined that there is an allergy, because of course some children do have a gluten allergy or casein allergy. It has nothing to do with the autism, but as typical developing kids may have food allergies, some of our kids may as well, And if, along with your pediatrician, it was determined that the best way to look at that allergy, the treatment for that allergy, of course, is to remove those foods from the child's diet. Let me move on to the second part of the question is, the parent has started the gluten and casein-free diet 3 weeks ago. That is not a very long period of time. If we look at, and I want to give some statistics on how long does it take a typical developing child to acquire a new food, meaning you may have your, thinking back on our child development, a two-year-old, a one-year-old, two-year-old, and we might introduce a new food. Let's say we introduce broccoli or we introduce peaches. How long does it take that child to start accepting that food, asking for that food, and including that food in their list of repertoire of their foods that they eat? That can take several months for a typical child. If we look at the research, it says that it can take up to 10 to 15 times for a child to have a positive exposure to a food before we accept that food and the child may request it and want it again. So we know that if we look at typical development, oftentimes that 1 and 2 year old, we offer them a food and they throw it on the floor. Or we offer them again and they might pick it up and look at it and then they throw it on the floor. And again, as each time we offer that food to the child, they're not going to automatically pick up that food and put it in their mouth. Again, it may take 10 to 15 times for a typical child to accept that food. Now, if we have a child with a developmental disability, and on top of that, maybe some oral motor issues or some sensory issues, you can see where it's going to take many times to offer that food before the child will accept it. So I tell parents, that's all right. Put the food back on the plate. Offer it to them again. Now, when I say offer, let me not confuse that with force them to put it in their mouth. An offering is simply that. It's on the plate. Maybe the child picks it up, and certainly a four-year-old would still be using their fingers at some for some foods, and it's important that that child have the experience of holding that food. We have the most receptors not only in our hands and fingers and in our mouths, and so it's really important that we allow our child, let's say we're going to offer them a new gluten and casein-free food, that we offer them an opportunity to explore that food away from the mouth. So I tell parents, if you're going to transition to that type of diet, then what you're going to want to do is pair that food over a period of time with the food that they're already eating. I would not go cold turkey. I would do this in a systematic way. So you may still use some portions, and it can be a small portion, of an item that may have gluten or casein in it, and I want the parent to pair it with that gluten and casein-free product, okay? So what we know is when we pair foods together, a new food with a food that we already like, we tend to accept that food more, and I think that's true for many of us. If we're trying something new, it's easier if we also have things on our plate of foods that we already are comfortable with, that we already know that they're safe to put in our mouths. So to this parent, what I would say is, if, again, you've determined with your pediatrician to go that route of a gluten and casein-free diet, 3 weeks is not a long time in the life of a four-year-old, particularly a four-year-old that may have some other eating concerns going on. What I want you to do is just put it on their plate, pair it up with an item that they're already eating, that's a preferred item, and then slowly and systematically you're going to wean that child off your gluten and casein-free, your gluten and casein products until the child's more accepting that. What I don't want to see is a four-year-old going hungry, and if this child is rejecting foods for 3 weeks and they're throwing it back at mom, I'm worried about that child getting enough nutrition every day. So let's go back a few steps. Let's look at the long-term plan. And again, the long-term plan is your gluten and casein-free diet for this family. But we need to do it systematically and not just take all the foods away from this child. We're going to pair them up. And again, we're going to let the child explore the new food and it may take many trials or 10 to 15 offerings before that child accepts that food. So I hope that makes sense to that parent.
Those are really good points that you make there, Dr. Lori, because it's true that it sometimes we think, oh my gosh, we have to do everything immediately and quickly, that we lose sight of the long-term goal. And even with special diets, you need to be off of certain foods for a certain length of time to even see if that diet is effective. So it is much better to do as you say and to start gently to have the child accept the new diet, because you're going to have to be on that new diet for quite some time before you see if it's effective or not.
That's a good point. That's right.
Okay, here's a question from Christy Copperas Cove, Texas. My son is getting older and he doesn't want bread and gluten. Dairy is hard to send in to lunches at school. So far he eats lunch from the cafeteria but hardly eats anything, and I'm worried. What should I do?
I'm sorry, but did she say how old? She just says he's getting older.
Getting older, but she doesn't mention how old he is.
Okay. Well, as we know, and you know, as your children have gotten older, food tastes change. You know, as they get into teen years, they can change, and we see that oftentimes. I think as a parent, you know, again, going back to what's your long-term goal here, she wants to pack his lunch. Is that her goal? If so, you know, what can we do, what can Christy do with that child to pack the lunch ahead of time? Sometimes parents, you know, we kind of do that at night, and then the child the next day, it's not something that they would have planned for themselves. So I'll often put out some choices, especially as kids get older, we need to give them more choices. So as mom, I would suggest that she, even if she had pictures and said, okay, here's four choices for some protein, maybe four choices for a fruit and vegetable, four choices maybe for a carbohydrate, whatever that family has decided upon, and have the child pick and maybe do some planning ahead of time. I always go back to some of us remember many years ago, Richard Simpson had that deal-a-meal, and that's what I do. I kind of do a deal-a-meal program with the teenagers that I work with and the older upper 10, 11, 12-year-olds, and have them start to pick themselves. So part of it might be just kind of a power and control issue. He doesn't want mom packing his lunch. I'm not sure where we are in terms of age and functioning level. So I would put it back on the child. But mom and dad need to be responsible for picking what those choices are. Did I cover all of that for that question?
Hey, you did. And I think I would like to mention, too, because I have two teenagers and one is neurosurgeon, and one is not. And so I learned a lot from reaching the teen years about teenage behavior in general, which has nothing to do with autism. And some of those issues about food and packing lunches, oh my gosh, you have to see me with my 16-year-old neurotypical daughter. A, she wants me to pack her lunches, but B, she's sick of the lunches I pack.
That's right.
There's always a huge discussion about, you know, and I try, as Dr. Lori suggests, you know, giving her choices, okay, between this, this, and this, and this. But, and I'm not trying to make light of the food situation with kids on the spectrum, because it's a whole different ball game. But it's important to remember that as kids get older, they do get more noncompliant because they're teenagers, or they're reaching those years where they need to have more choices. And so it's really important as to do what Dr. Lori suggests, and giving them the choice of helping to prepare their lunches.
Yeah, that's just typical teenage behavior. And so if mom can sit down ahead of time, again, you know, kind of do a deal-a-meal with the student, with their child, and say, okay, here are some choices. And you know, making sure that they're fitting in with those typical developing kids, so.
Right, and it's also good, too, to sometimes visit the school at lunchtime to see what they are proposing in the cafeteria. Because maybe part of that deal is, okay, once a week you get to eat or twice a week you get to eat in the cafeteria, and here are some good choices from there.
Yeah.
I don't know if there are things that they particularly like there.
Sure.
Okay. Here's another one. This one's from Stephanie Stone from Sylmar, California. I've heard the best... Here we go again with the CFGF diet. I've heard the best plan is to place children on the spectrum on the GFCF diet. My son is pretty picky. He won't eat any vegetables, not even corn. As a matter of fact, it seems the only thing I can get him to eat are the very same items he is not supposed to have. How do I handle balancing his diet and getting him to eat what's good for him? By the way, hiding the veggies in his food does not work.
Okay. Got lots of good stuff there. Again, I just want everybody who's listening, it's my position, and I think this is a decision that's made between parents and their pediatricians and the other experts that they're working with, but I am a person who relies heavily on the science. And, you know, one thing I always run across, I know parents who try the gluten and casein-free diet, it's not cheap. You know, some of those foods can be expensive, ordering process. You know, I have to just say that if that parent has decided and with the pediatrician there is an allergy, let me talk about a few things as far as what's happening with her son. Is there an age for that child?
Not mentioned here.
Okay. Well, it doesn't, you know, we can look at how we introduce any new foods. First of all, this child is experiencing what we call food jags. Now, a food jag is the insistence on the same food, the same way, the same plate. I mean, I see children who insist on the same kind of cup, the same kind of maybe a video that has to be playing or they won't eat. And those are called food jags. Now, some food jags are where they will only eat a certain brand name. Our kids are very brand specific. You know, they're not just going to eat any old French fry. It's got to be from Wendy's. Or they're not going to eat any yogurt. It's got to be Yoplait custard style. And so when we see a child, and I should also say that food jags is a normal, typical developing behavior, meaning that two-year-olds, if we look at the studies out there of young children, 2 and 3 years old, they will often food jag, eat peanut butter and jelly every day for a month, have a hot dog for dinner every day for a month. The difference between, from what I'm seeing, for a typical developing child and a child on the spectrum is that our kids on the spectrum, they food jag for years. And when, after a period of time, it could be a year, they will often drop that food from their list of foods that they eat. So what happens is you may have a five-year-old who is eating hot dogs every day, and he eats them every day for a year. Well, after that year is up, or 6 months, when they stop eating those hot dogs, they don't go back to it. Where a typical child may eat peanut butter and jelly for a month, then he's going to switch to something else, and then he's going to go back to peanut butter and jelly. What happens is, and I hear this over and over again from parents, they say, yes, my child eats macaroni and cheese, but he used to eat these other foods as well, like he used to eat hot dogs or he used to eat chicken nuggets, and he won't eat them anymore. And that's because what happens is, as parents, we supported that food jag by providing that food every day in the same way, on the same plate, in the same, you know, manner, and then the child finally will drop that food from their list of foods. So it is a very, it's a serious issue, and I caution parents, do not support the food jag, meaning that what I'll tell parents is just try changing that food just a little bit. Chicken nuggets. We've got a lot of chicken nugget kids out there. Maybe one day you're going to have the chicken nuggets on your favorite Barney plate, and then the next day we're going to have chicken nuggets on a different plate. Maybe it's just changing the utensils. Maybe it's how we cut the chicken nuggets. Maybe it's adding a different sauce to the chicken nuggets. So I tell parents, keep exposing them to changes. Now, I don't want to make the change too big, so I'm not going to go from a chicken nugget to a chicken leg or a whole chicken breast, because that might be too big of a change. But I could go from chicken nuggets to turkey nuggets. I could go from chicken nuggets from Tyson chicken nuggets to trying a different brand of chicken nuggets. So keep in mind, parents, the more you offer that food the same way every day, the likelihood that in the future that child is going to stop eating that food and they're not going to go back to it. And so that's the scary thing for me, because then as a consultant, I'll see an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old who used to eat maybe 20 different foods when they were 5, but by 8, they're down to 10 foods. By 10, they're only down to 3 foods that they will eat. So the list gets shorter and shorter, because as parents, we feel responsible for our kids eating. And I'm going to talk about that tonight, is the parental responsibility in terms of eating. But we need to be careful. So think about, how can you change macaroni and cheese? What about putting a little food coloring in it? And do this with the child. I will often with a child who's has to have macaroni and cheese, has to be the Kraft macaroni and cheese. What we'll do is I'll give them a different kinds of food coloring, add some of that to it. It doesn't change the taste, but at least it will change what it looks like. So think about adding different textures. Think about the shape. Making slight, gentle changes, not huge changes. Again, I don't want the child to throw the food on the ground and be so upset they won't eat. Do it with your child, making these changes. And sometimes we really have to put our thinking caps on how do we take a food like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Maybe we're going to use our cookie cutters and make them into different shapes. Slight changes, that way the child is not going to reject when we show them a different food. So that's information about food JAGs, and that I want parents to consider, how can they make changes. Another thing I would say is, let's go back to the macaroni and cheese. Let's say you want to play around with food coloring with your child, which is a lot of fun. I know it makes kind of an ugly color when you put green in there, but it doesn't matter what color it is. I want it to keep it fun for the child, but maybe also offer him the macaroni and cheese without the food coloring in it, so that they're not going to be overwhelmed with those changes. So I might have a few tablespoons of macaroni and cheese with food coloring and some without, and then I'm going to offer them both. So gentle changes, look at those food JAGs, and again, especially if you're with the younger kids under 8, they may be eating a few foods now, but I just hate to see a few years from now and all of a sudden that list gets shorter and shorter. And I've worked with, you know, older students, they're down to just one food that they will eat, and that is going to greatly impact their ability to learn, their ability to live independently, go on vacations with families, all sorts of things. So let me go on to the next thing that she talked about, which is hiding foods. Well, I could not agree with her more. She is so right. Hiding or sneaking food into another food does not work. And unfortunately, sometimes we do this, again, because parents, we feel responsible. We want to make sure our kids get their vegetables, and so we're going to puree those carrots up and hide them in another food, the spaghetti sauce, or hide other foods. And I can only tell everybody to think about, how would that feel for yourself? Let's say you go to a restaurant. You go to somebody's house for dinner. You sit down. You expect to just be eating spaghetti. And you bite into that food, and you find something that's not supposed to be there. There's nothing more revolting and scary to know that, oh, there's something in my mouth that I didn't expect. And so we have to respect our children. Maybe in the short term for that parent, yeah, it's the easy way to get those carrots in there, or take a brownie and I'm going to hide some vegetables in the brownie. That's a short-term fix. What that is not is a long-term teaching to that child of eating a food. You know, we can't be having these kids as they get to be adults and we're hiding foods in there. So don't do the short-term fix. Think long-term. And I just disagree, whether it's for typical developing children or kids on the spectrum with a developmental delay, I do not agree with hiding foods and sneaking items into foods. It's just not respectful to the child.
And I think that all of us, with our taste buds, can usually tell the difference between beets and our favorite food.
That's right. That's right. Again, that's respecting the child. We think, oh, I'm going to trick him. And you're going to lose the child's respect. And the child's not going to trust you. I watched a therapist hide some cookies that she crumbled up into this child's pudding. And the look on this poor child's face when he bit into his favorite pudding, and I don't know what these cookies were, but he was disgusted and he threw it down and he couldn't, unfortunately he was nonverbal, but I knew he was thinking, why did you do that to me? You know, don't hide a food. I don't think it respects the child.
Good point. Now here's a suggestion that someone just sent in now. This is Michael, the dietitian, who's the mom of a 23, so maybe it's Michelle, the dietitian, mom of a 23-year-old person on the spectrum from Columbus. And her suggestion is try freeze-dried vegetables and fruits. They have the texture of Cheetos, and we use it for ABA therapy.
Hmm. You know, and there's more to she makes a very good point, and I was very fortunate, both Tanya and I, when we wrote the book, to consult with a couple of dietitians because, you know, again, we needed to be familiar about the different foods and how would be the best way to introduce a food. And the point that she's making that to me is also important is we don't always have to serve our foods warm. And a child that has a sensory issue to smells, it's better to serve that food cold. And so even if it's meat, or, you know, some of us think there's nothing better than, you know, nice warm broccoli or a warm vegetable. What I do is I would prefer to serve it room temperature or even cold, as this mom is saying. And to me, it helps reduce some of the sensory in terms of the smell of the food. It doesn't have as much as the odor, at least when we first start introducing a new food. So she has a good point there.
That's really interesting. I never thought about the temperature, hot, cold, and how it smells more or differently when it's warm.
Sure. And to most of us, we prefer, you know, our soup warm or our chicken is going to be warm, our hamburger is going to be warm. But one of the things that we'll often do is, you know, make them cold. We might even put them in the freezer, get them a little chilled. That way the child is not getting overwhelmed with the smell at first. One sensory at a time.
Right. Okay, moving right along because we've got a lot to cover here. It's so interesting. My son has autism and low muscle tone, and he gags whenever we feed him anything other than Gerber's third stage baby food. Mm-hmm. Is this typical of children on the spectrum, or is this due to low muscle tone or something else? And this is from Gina W. from Homer.
Okay, well, Gina, I would not say that we see low muscle tone as a specific characteristic for autism, although there certainly are children with autism that have low muscle tone. It's just not something that I could say is pervasive with the whole population. Now, having said that, I'm wondering why she thinks he has low muscle tone. Just because you gag, that doesn't mean you have low muscle tone. So maybe she's worked with a therapist at school or at private practice who has said that he has low muscle tone. She may want to look at that. That's something that we cover in the book is, you know, what are some of the signals for low muscle tone, you know, a reduced strength in the mouth. The tongue is unable to move the food around in the mouth, so the tongue may have low muscle tone. Keep in mind, all the muscles in your jaw are just like any muscle in your body. The less you use them, the less strength they have. So this child who's still on stage 3, he's not working out his mouth. Think about your biceps, think about your quadriceps. You know, the more we work them out, the stronger they get. And if I only have to swallow a food without chewing it, then I've lost muscle tone in my mouth. We can build muscle tone, though. There are tools out there, chewy tubes. There are tools that many of a good therapist will use to build up jaw strength. if you think about how many chews it takes to chew a piece of chicken, I mean, we all just put the food in our mouth, chew and swallow, but, you know, when we do that in with a child and we have them count how many chews does it take, it can take 20, 25 chews to chew a piece of chicken or a hamburger. And if that child has never had any jaw strength, of course they're going to gag because they don't know what to do with that food in the mouth. So one of the things I'm going to say that this parent might consider is getting some chewy items and go to, even though she doesn't say how old her son is, but I'm assuming he might be a little bit, maybe he's 3 or 4, go back to the infant section in your local Target and Walmart. Get those chewy toys again. I know you may think, oh, he's outgrown those, but he hasn't. He needs to work on that oral motor development. Again, we've got references in the back of our book, as well as I mentioned Suzanne Evans-Morris at the beginning of our topic. And Suzanne has a wonderful website. She also has great chewing tools that parents can purchase, and they're easy to use. But I would like to see that mom sitting down with her child every day practicing chewing. And so, again, go to your local store, get some of those baby items that we've all used when our children were 6 months old, because that's where her child is in terms of food. So we can build up the strength in the mouth just like we build up any other muscle that we have in our body. But it's going to take work on it every day, and not with a food item. We need to practice it with something safe, like a chewy tube. There's lots of chewy tubes out there. If you're looking at some of those catalogs as parents, I always will look at a catalog called TheraPro. And TheraPro is a great website. Parents can buy things like chewy tubes, but it needs to be under adult supervision. It's not something I'm sticking in the child's mouth. I'm going to do it with the child. They have a chewy tube. I would have the parent imitate with them, and we're going to practice chewing and building up those muscles in the tongue, moving the chewy tube around. Lots of those oral motor activities that are going to strengthen the tongue, the jaw, the cheeks, the lips. Sometimes I'll put a knot in the chewy tube and then have the child hold it in the lips and you know, just kind of play a little tug and war. Again, we're making it fun, though. These are just little activities that are fun, but they can be, some of those tools can be found, again, at TheraPro. Abilitations is another catalog that's going to have some of those products out there. And the other one that I would recommend to this mom in your baby department is called a baby safe feeder. Baby safe feeder, again, it's for a small child, 6 to 1 month typically, and it's a small mesh bag that has a screw top on it, and the purpose of that baby safe feeder is for young children to practice chewing on a food and tasting new flavors. But the food is not going to go down the child's throat because it's caught inside this mesh bag, the screen, okay? So if you can imagine a very small, it's got a handle on it so the child can grip it. And I would say to the parent, you know, first practice with the stage 3 baby food that they're already using. So take your baby safe feeder, dip it in the stage 3 baby food, and just have the child practice putting it to their lips, licking it with their tongue. Again, we let the child take the lead. If the child seems scared, the child is upset, okay, we're done. We're going to finish that right then. Come back to it the next day. Again, let the child, they will let you know how long, you know, will they be able to, you know, handle that and endure that. So get a baby safe feeder. First practice with the stage 3 baby food. Then I'm going to add a food in there, something close to maybe a flavor that they're eating already. So maybe they like pureed peaches. Now I'm going to put a slice of a peach. Now the child can practice chewing, but that mesh bag is going to hold any of the particles from getting into the child's mouth. The child can feel safe that they're not going to gag. The other thing about gagging can also be a learned behavior that a child will exhibit to get a food away from them. And so what I see sometimes is, you know, I'll work with a child, I'll get some new foods out, and the child will gag just looking at the food. Well, what that child has learned over time is, if I gag, my mom and dad will take the food away, right? So it's one of those responses that sometimes our kids learn. So if the child starts gagging, I don't want the parent to become fearful or become anxious, but don't remove the food. Just say, that's okay, we're going to leave it on the table, right? Maybe we'll touch it a little bit. Maybe at the end of the meal we'll kiss it goodbye, but we're just going to leave it here. Don't overreact to gagging, because then our children learn, oh, if I gag, if I do this behavior, the food goes away. So be calm. Say, that's okay, you don't have to put it in your mouth, but we're just going to leave it here. You know, maybe tomorrow we'll try, you know, putting it in the baby's safe feeder. Right. So those are a couple suggestions for Gina.
Yeah, those suggestions actually help a lot of folks who have written in similar type of questions.
Yeah, a lot of people, and I saw a couple of those questions about how to introduce a new food.
Yeah.
And I would use that baby safe feeder for kids, and I've used it up for kids, even into those young teens. You know, I want to respect the child, but I want them to know, we're going to put this food in there. You have control over whether you put it in your mouth. You have control over when, how much time you chew it. But it's a great way for to expose a child in a gentle way to a new food without them putting the food directly on their tongue. That is a really scary thing. And one of the things I need to talk about is food neophobia, which is a fear of new foods. And that is a real thing. That exists for all. We are all hardwired to be fearful of putting things in our mouth. You know, that way we don't go around just sticking any old thing in our mouth and or something that's not supposed to go in there. So we all have a little bit of fear of new foods. And so, again, it's not surprising to me that some of our kids on the spectrum, that is, they have that true fear, and the fear comes from, I'm not sure I can handle it if that food goes in my mouth. So food neophobia is real. It's all part of all of us. Some of us, and Chantal, you may know people and who are, even as adults, very picky, you know, who won't go to new restaurants and they're not going to try that new Thai food, or, you know, they won't go to a buffet because if they don't know what it's in it, they don't want to eat it. So that's all a little bit of that fear of food. And so I think we can relate to other friends that we might have or adults that are fearful of new food. So it does exist. I think we just need to take it slower than for our kids.
And I had a question for you, Dr. Lori, because when I read many of these questions and just knowing from the people that I meet, you know, in everyday life here dealing with autism, in America, most of the diet things that kids say that they end up eating, it's macaroni and cheese, it's chicken nuggets, it's french fries. And I'm thinking, have you worked in foreign countries, and is it the same thing? Because being French, I just can't imagine that being things that a French child with autism is going to be eating, because it's just not part of their diet. So I kind of wonder how much cultural things.
Although I haven't had an opportunity to travel overseas, I do quite a bit of consulting by email. My book is available in Europe, and so I have my email address in the book, and we can share that with everybody tonight if people, you know, if there's anything, questions that maybe I don't get to tonight. And so we can definitely give that out here in a minute. But from my emails, I had an email recently from a mom in Denmark, and I've been back and forth with a woman in France. And although you're right, macaroni and cheese and chicken nuggets are something that's a little bit more typical to Americans, that the food jags, the fear of new food, the decrease in the list of foods that kids eat, that is still prevalent no matter what country you're in. As a matter of fact, Lorna Wing, which many of us know, Lorna Wing as a medical doctor and a leading expert in the field of autism from England, She did a study in her clinic of how many children in her clinic had these types of food aversions and eating challenges. And one of her studies suggested that almost 70% of the children in her clinic, and this again is in England, had the same kinds of food aversion. So I think this is something that we see, you know, universal around the field of autism and Asperger syndrome.
Right. It just might be that the food is different.
That's right. Whatever they're food jagging on is certainly not going to be, you know, chicken nuggets from McDonald's.
Here's a very good question that I'm sure would be helpful to a lot of parents if you can advise in some way. This one comes from Kathleen Pearson from Sherman Oaks. Are public schools responsible to provide OT for food aversions? I've been told it must be worked on at home and that it's not education-related and therefore not provided. However, once my son is in school full day and not wanting to eat at school because he likes to eat at home on certain plates with certain utensils, etc., I feel it is somewhat school-related and definitely an issue. I'm concerned that he will go through the full school day without eating much, and this will affect his learning ability, his concentration, his energy, and so forth, not to mention that he is at already a much lower weight range for his age, height, and can't afford to lose a single pound. What do you think the stance is on that about public schools being responsible?
Well, she brings up a very good point, and it's an issue that I hear again and again over there, and I can't say more clearly that public schools are definitely responsible for addressing these issues around food aversions and eating challenges. Having said that, the problem is most school OTs and speech and language pathologists are not trained to address eating, and because of that, sometimes I'm not sure if I would want them being the people who are leading that team for the feeding program. You need to be highly trained. If not, you can do more damage than good. And if you are in there, if you're not sure how to deal with things like some of the oromotor issues, if you're not familiar with how to use specific tools for oromotor development, I would worry about an OT that maybe should not be the person who's the lead person on that feeding clinic. But as a parent, I would still go into it requesting an OT eval, put it in writing. If they deny it, as with anything, it's your procedural safeguards to write a letter to the principal, make sure you keep a copy for your records, send it by registered mail that you've been denied OT services so that you have a paper trail, because I believe strongly that schools need to step up to the plate in this area. If you have a child who's not eating all day, we have kids out there who won't even drink water at school. There is no way that that is not impacting your ability to learn. And so here you have a child who's already got low weight. You know, they're going all day without eating, and that school is just not thinking this through in terms of what their responsibility to provide safe, a free, appropriate public education. And so if that parent is still getting resistance, as I always tell families, you know, you need to go to your local parent group and bring an advocate with you to that next meeting and make sure that that school knows that you mean business in terms of you're not just going to let this go and let them say no to you. You're going to pursue it. Always be the squeaky wheel. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. Do it in a professional manner. But I not just myself, but other eating experts out there will say that, yes, public schools, that is part of our responsibility, is to help kids who are not able to eat in school.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you so much. Now, I'm going to group a couple of these questions because even though they're not exactly the same, they're kind of related.
Okay.
This is from Nana in Tacoma. I tried taking away all foods that he, or maybe it's Cindy Lubowski. It's hard to tell from the way
things are okay.
Anyway, this mom has tried taking away all foods that the son liked and put out only the foods that the rest of the family was eating. My son did not eat for 4 days. He was 7 at the time. I finally gave in. He is now 16 and 80 pounds overweight. Is it too late to change his habits? And then this other parent asks, is it ever too late to try a new diet with any child who is autistic? I have two sons who are 14 and 15. The younger one is nonverbal, and his behavior is frustrating, and my oldest son has Asperger's. I've been told that their window of opportunity has long passed and closed, and I waited too long, but I feel that is not so. Financially, I was unable to do so at the time, and these doctors didn't take medical insurance. I feel terrible and guilty for my son's condition. Could you please help me? Those issues are a little different, but this whole point
Well, let's hit. I've got a couple of things that I want to address there. First of all, the one mom who took away the foods, again, the parents are figuring out there what doesn't work. Hiding food does not work. Depriving the child of their preferred foods does not work. One of the myths around eating is that children will not starve. And I have heard pediatricians even say this. Children will not starve themselves. Well, this mom, as well as many parents out there, know that that's not the case. Some of our children that have serious food aversions and eating challenges will most definitely starve. And so, unfortunately, there's some myths out there around eating, and that's one of them. So I would never would deprive the child of food.
But now 80 pounds overweight, which is
different. Now the reason that he's overweight now is because he is allowed to eat more than what a serving size is. And that's a big issue that I see with families. Parents, and let me go back to something about the role of the parent here, and that will clear up this. Then we'll get into serving size. One of my favorite resources in the eating world is a woman by the name of Ellen Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R. I wish as a parent of two children, I wish I would have had her books when I was first being a mom, because she is very insightful. She's a registered dietitian, and she has a couple of books out there, How to Get Your Kids to Eat But Not Too Much, and Secrets of Feeding a Healthy Family. If you look at Amazon.com, any of those, look for Ellen Satter. And one of the things that Ellen Satter reminds us of as parents is she talks about what is our parental responsibility when it comes to the meal times. We as the parents are responsible for what our children eat. We are responsible for when they eat. We're responsible for where they eat and how much they eat. So as a parent, you are responsible for what you get at the grocery store. You're responsible for what is the serving size of that dish that you're serving. You're responsible for where the child eats. So some of our kids, parents are allowing them to eat in their bedrooms and allowing them to just eat anywhere in the house. That is not, you know, that is not following the parental responsibility guidelines. What a parent is not responsible for is whether or not the child puts the food in the mouth. And oftentimes we step over that line, and as the parent, we say, you must eat that. You must take 5 bites. You must take 2 bites. You must put that food in your mouth. And when we step over that line is when we create a negative relationship with that food and that child. That child will become more averse to new foods if you force them to eat. Never does forcing a child to eat end up with that child eating better, particularly kids on the spectrum. So let's follow what Ellen Satter says. As a parent out there, you are responsible for when your children eat. And again, I see parents giving up this level of responsibility and allowing their children to eat whenever they want. So the child comes home from school and he wants a snack. Okay, that's fine. He gets a snack. An hour later, the child wants more food. The parent is allowing that. An hour later, when it's time for dinner, do you think that child's going to be hungry for food? No, he's just had 2 meals before that. And so we give up what we're really responsible for is, and something that we talk about in the book is, where's your schedule? Where's your schedule for eating? When is the kitchen open and when is the kitchen closed? But as parents, especially if you have a picky eater, if you have that child that comes to you at 9 o'clock at night and some way communicates to you or says to you, I'm hungry, most moms and dads will want to give that child some food. Now, that child did not eat dinner or that child had other issues in terms of eating, but this is where the parent needs to be strong and say, oh, I'm sorry, the kitchen's closed, but you can have breakfast in the morning. We need to keep our kids on a schedule of eating. We know that's what works best so that when they get to that meal, at least they're hungry and they haven't been allowed to have free access to food all day. So this child who's 80 pounds, one of my guesses, and again, going along with Ellen Satter, reminds us of is parents take responsibility. The schedule is up to you as well as how much. And so one of the recommendations, and this was really from a dietitian that I worked with here in Las Vegas, is all meals, as when you set the table, make sure you're putting your serving spoons that are your measuring cups and tablespoons, measuring tablespoons, right on the table. Because oftentimes what a parent will do, let's go back to the macaroni and cheese kid. This is one of the only foods he'll eat. So mom makes up the macaroni and cheese, and instead of giving him one serving size, we know that he's hungry, so we let him eat the whole box. Well, there's almost three servings in a box of macaroni and cheese. Again, as parents, we need to rein in our responsibility and say, let's look at a serving size, and it's only whatever it is, a half a cup. If parents want to go to, maybe you're not sure what is a serving size for your child, the United States at the Food and Drug Administration has a great website for parents to go to at the USDA.gov, and it's a food pyramid for children. And what I do with the parents that I work with directly is I make them copy that food pyramid and put it on the refrigerator as a reminder to the whole family. We're not here, you know, we're as parents, we're going to take our responsibility. When our kids eat, where's the schedule? What they eat, what are we bringing into the house, and how much? That's a big issue. So my guess with that mom is she really wanted to make sure, as a nurturing mom, that she fed her child. But she crossed that line of responsibility, and so we need to be really careful with that. So I want, again, Ellen Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R. These are not technical books. Ellen's books are for parents in layman's terms. But I think it really outlines for parents to say, it's okay if you've got a picky eater. See, what happens is people will judge you as the parent on how your child eats. So grandma's going to say to you, I can't believe he's not eating here at the holiday. Or the next door neighbor, the lady, you know, the lady down the street or somebody at school, we will often say, is he a good eater? We judge people on how they eat. And then we judge the parent. And so I think Ellen Satter reminds us that where our responsibility lies and what are the things that we can and cannot do. So having said that, check out her work. It's really great. And then I never starve a child. My recommendation, when families are introducing new foods, the child should always have on the plate a preferred food, but only a serving size. So if the parent who was introducing some gluten and casein-free foods, yes, keep some of the old foods as you're making that transition, but only a serving size. So that may just be a half a cup or a quarter cup. For a child who's four, a serving size for something like peas is only four tablespoons. It's the age of the child. And then it goes to about a quarter cup and a half cup. And I think it's a good reminder. So never starve them. Always have a preferred food on the plate. There should be a reason for that child to come to that meal every night, and it should be a sit-down meal at the table, but it should only be a serving size. Let me see. Let me go to that. The last part of that question was, is there a window of opportunity? Well, as with any strategies, you know, early intervention, of course, the brain has more a neuroplasticity when they're younger. They do learn more in those certain areas. But I, as an educator, could never close the window on teaching a child. And I've worked with teenagers, young adults. And so I think it may take a little longer, and we may not have the success that we might hope. But with a young man. He was a late teen, 18, 19-year-old. As I was working with him, he didn't increase the number of foods that he ate by quite a bit. But what happened that the parents were so pleased about was he would sit down and have dinner, at least sit there with the family every night. And they had a pleasant, at least, 15, 20 minutes every night. And he would go to relatives. He wouldn't make comments about food. So we didn't, you might say, oh, he didn't eat, 40 new foods. But in terms of his quality of life and the quality of life of that family, we made a lot of headway in that 18, 19-year-old young man, because he was now able to know that he could at least be around food and he could be calm and not be anxious about it.
Right, because food is also, eating is also a social experience. And so at least it seems like he came a long ways in a social experience. Which
exactly.
Really
yeah. Even something simple, this was a young man who when I started working with him, he needed a different utensil for every food that he ate. For him it was a sensory thing and he just didn't want food from, well, that's very cumbersome when you go to a restaurant, when you go to grandma's house, when you go to a birthday party. That kind of interfered again. And so we were able to work on that, just eating with one spoon and decreasing the negative comments about food. So some of those things, like you just said, increasing that social experience, which for many of us, that's what food is all about.
Right, and there's one thing that I want to mention because you've kind of brought it up every time you talk about a response and also a parental responsibility, is that a lot of the things that you're talking about doing, it's not going to work the first time, the second time, the third time, or the fourth time. People are going to have to just keep presenting or trying because things don't happen overnight, especially with kids on the spectrum. But even neurotypical kids, with things that you try and change and in terms of habits and so forth, as a parent, you just have to kind of be neutral in your response, but put it out there all the time so that eventually people get used to it. It's not an easy fix that's going to happen overnight.
It is not an easy fix, although I will say, Chantal, sometimes the child is ready to eat a new food, but the reason they haven't is because they've been under that thinking where the parents are forcing them to eat. And as soon as we get the parents more relaxed, one of the rules that we have that you'll see in the book is you're not allowed to sit at that dinner table and talk about the child's eating. You're not allowed to say, have you had your three bites, or you can't get away from the table until you eat that, or you can't have your dessert. The child cannot be the center of that family time. The family time has to just be about how was your day and just being together. And so oftentimes when we can turn the parents around and say, okay, I'm not going to be anxious, because you bring a lot of stress to the table then. And if that child is stressed, one of the ways that we deal with stress, any of us, is either fight or flight. And that's just how we're hardwired. And so if if that parent is trying to get that child to eat, put food in their mouth, demand that they take so many bites, you're actually diminishing the opportunity for that child to experience eating new foods. And so I always say, take a break from it. We're not going to talk about eating. We're not going to talk about how many bites you had. We're not going to, we're just going to concentrate on just being together during that 10 or 15-minute time period. And sometimes, and it doesn't happen all the time, that child is ready to eat, and that child will then, on their own, because we are hardwired to eat. And so sometimes if we just take the stress off, the child is willing to take the next step.
Very good. Okay, here's a kind of a long comment and question, and it's from Kathy in Oregon. Mealtimes are always a battle with my 4.5-year-old son with ASD. What he will eat for others, he will not eat for me. It is constantly take another bite, asking him to eat. Well, you just
okay, let's
about
just stop right there. Let's go back to what I just said. Of course meals are bad battles, right? Because this mom is breaking one of Ellen Satter's rules. The mom is feeling responsible for the child putting food in their mouth. And so the mom is demanding that he take a bite. And what's the child doing? The fight or flight. And so other people who just put the food on the child's plate and let the child go at his own pace and do it on his own, of course the child isn't going to have the same response. So here is where, as a parent, we need to change our behavior with our child around food time. If it's a battle, we need to look at and examine what our behaviors are. Go ahead and continue, but I wanted to stop with the beginning of that.
Okay. We've changed times, utensils, plates, and chairs. He will snack all day long, but not to eat a whole meal. I've cut things into shape. He goes to a special PK class, I guess that's pre-kindergarten.
Right.
And we prepare breakfast and lunch for him. He gets to choose what he wants, but he does not eat it or only takes a couple bites, not much. I've gone with, okay, you're done, and not giving snacks and waiting until the next meal time, but he still won't eat. Even if he picks out what he wants, he still does not eat it. Even if he helps prepare it, he doesn't eat it. I must also mention he is in the bottom percentile for his weight and top for height. Occasionally, he will drink a Pediasure. Okay, Pediasure, sorry.
Yeah, that's equivalent.
Okay. I've stopped calling it breakfast, lunch, and dinner and just told him it is a snack. I've waited until he tells me he is hungry. I'm not sure what to do next. He was just diagnosed in September, and the doctor is not concerned. Should I be? I've just purchased Special Diets for Special People, but I have not read that book yet.
Okay. Well, again, the beginning of that is really telling. The parent is struggling with her role at mealtime. And I think as parents, if we can just take a deep breath and try to remind ourselves, we are not responsible for whether the child puts that food in their mouth. That's up to that individual. As soon as we cross that boundary, we create the battles. When we create the battles, then our child is going to resist, fight or flight. Do you see how that's a chain reaction?
Yes. Yes.
If somebody was standing over you and forcing you to eat something you didn't want to eat, you're going to battle. You're going to fight them away. So that's where we have to start with this parent is, it's okay. Don't judge yourself as a parent just because your child is going through a period right now where they're not eating. Other things that stuck out for me in that question is, my child snacks all day long. Now let's go back. What are the rules for parents? You need to put your child on a schedule for eating. And that schedule needs to be posted. And so it needs to be very neutral. If the child comes to you and says, I'm hungry, just like we do for other behaviors, we say, let's check the schedule. We go to the kitchen. No, it's not time. It's got another hour. It doesn't have to be in a way that's, you know, we're not being punishment. It's just it's not time to eat yet. So I would say when I see snack all day, of course he's not going to be hungry at the meal. Also, the parent is giving this child too much responsibility for picking out their food. Because did she say how old he was?
Yeah, he's 4 and a half. That's a little
young. 4 and a half. Okay. He's too young to be picking out his foods. Back to Ellen Satter. What are you responsible for? When your child eats, where your child eats, what the child eats. We as parents need to step up to the plate there. So she needs to go back and look at what are appropriate and child-friendly foods for a 4-and-a-half-year-old. Now, I'm going to, again, and in case people missed the beginning, Suzanne Evans-Morris, the leading expert in the field of eating challenges and food aversions. She has a book called Pre-Feeding Skills. Now, I would caution parents, you might not buy that book because it's really more of a textbook for OTs and speech and language pathologists. So if you see her book on her website, I'll just tell you it's over 1,200 pages and it's quite technical. And so I'm not sure that would be the best place to start. But on her website, she gives a list of possible foods, and she lists them by the child's ability to chew the food. There's many different types of characteristics of food, the resistance of a food, how well it crumbles in your mouth, things that, you know, you and I, again, probably don't think quite a bit about. And so if a parent is wondering, What are some foods that are child-friendly foods? If you're just not sure, visit Suzanne Evans Morris, her website. And I don't think I gave you that website earlier, so let me do that really quickly. Suzanne's did I do it?
No, go right ahead.
Okay. This is a great website for parents to visit. It has a lot of, again, I mentioned early, she has oral motor tools on there that parents can purchase to practice chewing at home. And her website is www.new-viz, V as in Victor, I, S as in Sam, .com. The name of her company is called New Visions, and so the website is new-viz.com. You can just Google, of course, Suzanne Evans Morris, and you'll find her work. But if that parent is looking for what food should I offer, but at 4.5, I am not going to be negotiating through a lot of different food choices with that child. I'm going to take that responsibility. I'm going to select the foods and the portion size and where we're eating and when we're eating, and whether the child puts it in their mouth, that's up to the parent to back off and allow that child to experience that food.
Great. I wanted to mention that there's somebody named Bonnie Sayers in Los Angeles who wants to share that she has written a couple of reviews. One of them she did a few years ago on Just Take a Bite, and she has that on www.bellaonline.com. So that's B as in boy, E-double-L-A, online.com, /articles, /ART22408, .ASP. She also says she has reviewed another book. I'm looking up here because it's takes a while to scroll.
Okay.
To the other book that she mentions, Ellen's book. So cool. Ellen's book is also on that same website. And now she has a question or a comment. She says, a therapist never used a fork with my son. What are some ways to get a son who gets finger foods all the time and likes to take the cheese off the pizza but does not know how to use a fork? I don't know how old her son.
Okay, let's talk about utensils here for a minute. There's a lot of different kinds of utensils out there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I'm sorry, I heard a little beep and I thought maybe something happened. So we're talking about utensils, and this is something that, again, if she's working with a therapist, the therapist should be trying different kinds of utensils with the child. One of the things that happen often, not often, but sometimes with the kids that I work with, they are only using their fingers. And the reason for that is goes back to sensory processing in terms of proprioception, body awareness. So let's say you and I pick up a fork, and a fork is an extension now of our hand for like 4 or 5 inches. And if you don't know where your body is, and if you're not have good body awareness in terms of where are my hands, where are my, you know, what's my arm doing? That's your proprioception, which is body awareness. When you bring, and picture doing this, now you're going to bring that fork up to your mouth. But again, if you don't have body awareness, what's going to happen with that fork is you're going to end up stabbing yourself. You're going to gag yourself. Maybe you poke yourself in the gums. And so after trying several attempts at this, what do you end up learning? Oh, you know what? I can't use a fork, because I just need to use my fingers so I can feel the food and I know where my mouth is. Again, I know for some of us, sensory processing might be a newer area and the term proprioception might be new to you. But I will say, when I see this, what I would do for utensils is, first of all, have the child eat in front of a mirror. Now, how will that help? It will allow them to use their visual system to overcompensate for weaknesses in their proprioception. So if you have poor body awareness, but you have a good visual strength, visual awareness, you can now look with your eyes in a mirror and say, okay, where is that fork? Oh, I see it's coming towards my mouth. And in terms of motor planning, it's going to assist you or the child in using that utensil. Now, other things to think about utensils. you might try plastic utensils instead of metal, again, instead of, because they may, you know, poke themselves with it, and we want it to be safe. Plastic coated utensils are very helpful. There's also weighted utensils, W-E-I-G-H-T, so they're heavier. And if a child has a proprioception delay, we want to give them something with a little bit more weight so they can feel that fork or spoon in their hands. Also, there's different kind of grasps out there that you can put, just like a pencil grip. These are grips that go on your utensils. So lots of choices around utensils. But what I would, the one that I like to start with, if I find that there's a child and they're just not able to use a fork or spoon and they're really rejecting that, the one I like is actually from Gerber. We all have heard of Gerber. And Gerber has a spoon that's called the Little Dipper. And it's just L-I-L Dipper. And what I like about it is it is very small and it's got a chunky grip. And the spoon part of it is very small, but there's a plate, a guard, basically, at the end of the spoon, so the child can't put it too far in the mouth. They will not gag themselves. So it's a very small spoon, and it's not very deep. That's another problem with some spoons, is if they're too deep and you don't have good control over your lips, it's hard to get the food out of there. And so I will often use the Gerber Little Dipper. Again, go back to your infant area in your store and look for those. They're very inexpensive, just like the Baby Safe Feeder. You know, they're less than $5. And those are a great way for the child to practice bringing that up and dipping in things, you know, whether it's a sauce that they like. I dip it in ketchup if the child likes ketchup, because we just want them to practice before we move on to a fork or something that they, you know, they can have more difficulty with. So there's a whole progression when it comes to utensils. And if the therapist hasn't been exploring those, well, I mean, that's something I would be asking about, a weighted utensil. And always eat in front of a mirror so the child can use their visual system.
Very good. That's very good information. Here's an interesting question. I have a 13-year-old son on the spectrum. He is a very, very picky eater. The thing that concerns me is that he puts hot sauce and lemon pepper spice on the few foods that he does eat. This comes, by the way, from Katie Torres in Huntington Beach. I mean, he wants hot sauce and lemon on almost everything. He eats popcorn almost every day, but it has to be drenched in hot sauce and lemon. Chips the same. Chicken has to have lemon pepper, lots of it. He will get the hot sauce and drink it right out of the bottle. My concern is that this is really bad on his stomach. He's always complaining of tummy aches and gets diarrhea a lot. I tell him he is hurting the lining of his stomach. At school, instead of eating his lunch, he buys hot Cheetos. I can't seem to break him from this habit. I am very concerned for his health. How can I change this eating behavior? Even if I don't buy him the hot Cheetos, he will use his lunch money and buy them at school. He buys the hot stuff and hides it in his room. Please help me.
Okay. You know, I will say that, again, going back to the sensory system, just like we have kids that will seek out vestibular movement, we have kids who are seeking out proprioception or deep pressure, here is a child who's seeking out that gustatory or taste, which is one of our senses. So I think this, we would want to look at how can we help calm down his sensory system. You know, when we see a child who's seeking out other sensory areas, again, vestibular or movement or proprioception, they're seeking out that input, body input, we want to find strategies to calm down the sensory system. So I think it sounds like his sensory system is on overdrive. He's in the seeking mode. And my strategies, you know, whenever we see a kid in the seeking mode is, what kind of calming strategies can we use? So I would suggest to that parent of looking at some other of those sensory areas to help calm him down, whether that might be when he's eating, he uses a weighted blanket or a Lycra vest that he might wear under his clothes. I'm not sure if he's out in the typical cafeteria. So a weighted, there's those Lycra vests that you can put under your clothes, so it's very discreet. but I would be thinking of ways to help calm down his sensory system before he eats and during the time that he eats. Now, the other thing that I would also consider, since he's 13, and it sounds like he's pretty independent if he is buying his own lunch at school, so there's not an adult that's doing that for him. It sounds like he does that, is when I get those kids as they get older, I like to start teaching them about nutrition. And oftentimes when you go to any of your learning stores, so go to any of your learning, you know, educational stores that might be in your community, even oftentimes in your Barnes & Noble or Borders, they have a little section, and get the workbooks out on nutrition. There are several really good ones that are out there for typical kids, because I think we need to teach him about what's happening in his digestion. I know mom is talking about his stomach. She's talking about tummy aches. But we need to make it more concrete for him. We need to give him some visuals, like where does the food go? And that's something I'll often do with the kids is we draw pictures of where it goes, what happens in our stomach, especially as they're older and they have some more cognitive skills where we can really discuss some of these things. So mom might take some time every day, you know, instead of just kind of nagging him about, you know, the food is really hurting you, especially a teenager, I'm going to make it a little bit more scientific. And I'm going to use some books, so it's not just mom saying it. Now you actually have this book written by a professional on nutrition and what could be the harm of having some of this hot sauce or the lemon or eating these foods every day. So as our kids, as I work with kids that maybe are teenagers with Asperger's, I'll often talk to them about nutrition, and we learn a lot about how the digestive tract works. And if you're not eating, we talk about constipation and what that can do. And so I think education might be the key there. So the two things I would talk about is looking at calming down his sensory system. Again, weight is always a way to be thinking about calming that down. Any movement that is predictable movement is calming, like rocking back and forth is a calming movement. So calming his sensory system down, because it looks like he's a seeker. And then the other thing is teaching him, really sitting down and making this a scientific lesson every day about talking about what food does inside your body. Because he really, you know, it's probably hard for him to kind of imagine what that is. We need to make it more concrete and visual.
You know, that's really a good point, because oftentimes we forget about that teaching and explaining certain things to our kids on the spectrum. When it comes to neurotypicals, a lot of times neurotypical kids will nag us with questions, so then we think about explaining things to them, or else they're naturally getting it in some of their classroom materials. But
right.
For a lot of our guys on the spectrum, they're not naturally getting it, and they don't naturally ask questions.
So we have to make it a specific lesson every day as parents to teach about the body. You know, when I see teenagers and they're not eating, you know, we talk about what is the impact when you don't have nutrition in your system that affects your brain. And, of course, especially, you know, our teenagers with Asperger's, they want to be smart. They want to learn things, especially in their areas of interest. Well, if you want to learn about those things, then you're going to have to eat from each food group.
Right. Good point. Okay, my son is diagnosed with autism, and we are finding out many other things that have to do with digestion about him. For example, he has reflux. He is a very picky eater, and he has been very constipated for the past couple of months. The pediatrician put him on over-the-counter Myrelax for a week. He also takes Prevacid for his reflux. The Miralax has cleaned out his bowel, but he is constipated again, and the pediatrician says to do it for about 2 more weeks, and then call her, so maybe by then he will be regular. I don't think this will work. Do I need to put him on one of the diets for him to get possibly better and become a better eater? So this mom is really concerned about her son's health.
Most definitely.
Working.
Yeah, and I'm sorry I missed the age of that child. Did it?
It doesn't say how old he is.
Yeah. You know, reflux... you know, we do see that as we see it with typical developing children. We also see it with kids with autism. And when you have reflux, it does reduce your appetite. It reduces your ability to eat well. And it tends to lead to, you know, more picky eating. And so I think, you know, the Miralax, there's many different types of medications out there to reduce reflux, but hopefully she's had a swallow study done. If not, it's something that I would definitely be looking at talking to the pediatrician about a swallow study. These are not, you know, this is not a this is not something that I say lightly, because doing a swallow study can be pretty intrusive to the child. You have to go into a special room. You have to sit very quietly in front of an X-ray machine. You have to dip your food into barium, and then the radiologist is going to watch the child chew and swallow the food. But sometimes what we think is reflux, other things can be going on in terms of the esophagus. There's other areas that we say, oh, it's just reflux. Well, it might not be. And so one thing that I might recommend to that parent is talking to their pediatrician, should they look at doing a swallow study. Again, it is intrusive, and some kids it's difficult for them. If you have a good radiologist who's gentle, you know, I've seen it done very successfully with kids. But we need to rule out, to say it's just reflux is very generic. And so it may be that the Miralax they've given for the bowel, but some of the over-the-counter medications for his digestion may or may not be working. So that would be the first thing that I would ask the parent to do. And I'll often ask the parent to do is check with their pediatrician, should we be doing a swallow study. In terms of the constipation, it goes hand in hand, because if you have reflux or there's other things like to have esophageal dysmotility, that means your esophagus isn't working the way it's supposed to and food is going too slow and it's getting stuck, any of those things that are going on with the stomach and so forth reduces what we want to eat and drink. When we do that, then, of course, it leads to constipation because we're not eating foods that clean out our system. So they really go hand in hand. I would go back, talk to the pediatrician, and then look at what foods can you add in terms of foods that are going to have a little bit more higher fiber in them that will keep him regular. Constipation is a very serious condition. You know, many people experience constipation, and it's no big deal. We get over it. We drink plenty of water and clean things up. When you have long-term constipation, it can lead to definitely different medical problems that are very difficult and sometimes require surgery to fix. So it's not something to play around with. I think, you know, mom does need to be concerned, and I think it's something that she definitely wants to be addressing and be really proactive about this and not just, you know, kind of wait and see about that. So that would be my recommendation.
Good advice. There are a few people who have recently emailed in while we're talking some questions, and all of them have to do with introducing new foods, so I'm going
okay.
to read them.
Okay, good.
I may have missed the answer to this question that I submitted yesterday. What are some good strategies for children on the spectrum to try new foods that are preteen?
Okay, let's just talk about how do we introduce a new food. Let me go back to how we do it.
There are a few people who asked that question, but I wanted to read one more because this person who's been listening says, I'm not understanding you because on one hand you say don't let them starve, but you say only put down on the table what you know is healthy. If I only put down one thing that the child will eat and he would only eat that, then day after day he will only eat tiny bits of food till he starves. So I don't understand. So I guess that all kind of works in together with the new food. So maybe people need a little more clear indication or example.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she makes a good point because I did say parents are responsible for selecting the food. And as parents, we always make sure that there is a serving size of the preferred food at every meal. So, yes, having said that, and I want to make sure I state that clearly, at the same time, we need to be introducing new foods, and we need to do it every day. But I need to remind everybody, when we introduce a new food, it has nothing to do with putting the food in the mouth. See, there's another eating expert out there in the field that some of your listeners tonight might be familiar with, and her name is Kay Toomey, T-O-O-M-E-Y. Kay Toomey I've seen her and talked to her many times, and what she has done is looked at how many steps are there to eating. See, you and I feel like there's two steps to eating. The food's on the plate, and then the food's in the mouth, right? Those are the two steps, and then we just chew it and swallow it. When actually there's 35 steps to eating, 35, because it starts with, for kids with disabilities, especially kids that have developmental disabilities, it starts with that food being in the same room with them. Then it's that the food is just, is it on the table? Maybe not on their plate, but it's on the table. It's on mom and dad's plate. And then it moves to, can it be in a separate bowl next to their plate? So the beginning stages of introducing new foods is not having the child put that food near their mouth. When we try to force that is when you create that negative experience with the child. So what I tell parents to do is set up on your schedule every day fun with food time. And I want the parents to pick a food, whether it's broccoli or peaches or cantaloupe, or pick a food, and we're going to have fun with food. And I want that child to start creating a relationship with that food that's positive and fun. So one of the things that I'll do with kids right from the very beginning is I'll bring up some green beans and pieces of apple and cantaloupe and a broccoli. And then what we'll do is we'll get some straws and we'll have a contest. Who can blow that food the fastest across the floor or a table if we're sitting at a table? Now, to you and I, we're thinking, why are we doing that? Well, what we're doing, the therapy part, the goal in therapy, is to create a fun relationship with that food. So that child is chasing that green bean and chasing that broccoli as they're blowing it. And they're touching it, right? And they're smelling it. That's how you learn about a food. And so we need to create opportunities every day, not putting the food in our mouth, but away from the table, so we're creating a positive relationship with the food. And let's go back to what I mentioned earlier in the program. It may take 10 to 15 times, and this is based on the research on how long does it take a child to accept a new food in their food list, 10 to 15 times of positive offerings. Well, if you multiply that by 35 steps to eating, according to Kay Toomey, that's 350 times, you know. Now, I'm not saying it's going to take that long, but you made that point earlier. This is not a quick fix. So that mom who's asking, how do I introduce a new food? Exactly what I'm saying. Pick some foods, bring them home. How can you create a fun with food time? And we have got, you know, many, many examples of having fun with food in our book. But things like, what? Take the game Hot Potato. Instead of playing Hot Potato, I get the siblings in on it, and I get mom and dad, and we all sit down and play. We do it Hot Potato, but with a chicken leg. And we pass that chicken leg around and play the music. And does that kid now think about, oh, my gosh, I have to eat that chicken leg? No, no, no. All they're doing is touching it. So we need to create a different relationship with the food, and it's based on typical development, meaning you look at that six-month-old. And if you can think back, all of us, when the kids were little, we would put food on their tray, and they would pick it up with their hands, and they'd shove it in their ear, and they'd throw it on the floor, and half of it would go in their hair. But that's how you learn about a food. You've got to touch it and smell it and feel it in your hands and in your hair. But then as our kids get older, we expect them to just go from the plate to the mouth. So what I want parents to think about, do it right before bath time. Or what about in the bath? I like to throw vegetables, put cucumber slices in there, have the kids throw them in there, carrot sticks. You know, you and I may say, well, you don't put carrot sticks in the bathtub. Why not? Let the kid play with them, right? The more you do that, we know it creates a different relationship, and the more willing that child is going to be to eventually maybe take a small bite, maybe lick it, right? Again, we're not going to just take a bite and swallow it. What about take a bite, but we're going to take it out of our mouths and look at it? I do that with kids all the time. I say, it's okay. You could take a bite. Let's look at what it looks like. Because they need to feel safe before they chew and swallow it. Plus, going back to the baby safe feeder, get some of those new foods, put them in the baby safe feeder. Every day, let's dunk that baby safe feeder, put a piece of broccoli in there. I'm going to dunk it in. What about ketchup? Can you put broccoli in ketchup? Of course you can. The kid really loves ketchup. Let's dunk it in there and chew it in our baby safe feeder. Again, we want to exposure, gentle and positive exposures. And what we know is over time with these exposures, the child is going to feel more and more comfortable bringing the food to the mouth. One thing I love to do with kids is just have them kiss the food goodbye. So at the end of the meal, you know, they didn't really want to have anything to do with that chicken leg, or they didn't want to have anything to do with that broccoli or that carrot stick or whatever you had, bring them over to the trash can and say, okay, let's play slam dunk, you know, let's make a basket out of this. So kiss the food and slam dunk it. Kids love to do that because mostly they love to throw it away. But what happens when they pick up that food and kiss it? They're having another positive experience. So this is where the work comes in for the parent. If you're really serious about changing your child's relationship with food, if you really want to expose them in a positive way, one thing I always recommend to parents is just take a shower curtain, you know, the liners are $1.99. You get the liner, put it on the floor, and then, you know, bring a sibling in or whoever, put some food down there. Again, you can do everything. We've done bowling with food. We've done, instead of bobbing for apples, we've bobbed for kiwi and bobbed for chicken legs. And just think of everyday fun. Put a little music on. 5 to 10 minutes. It doesn't have to take a long time. Again, let the child take the lead, and you will be surprised. When that child does not feel forced, when the pressure and stress and anxiety is not there, you're away from the table, we're going to have fun with food. Now, the reason I don't want to do it at the table is because I still want to make sure that parents know that the playing with the food is something we do separate from the eating time. So, you know, that's why right before bedtime, because in case we get messy, we paint with food, so we'll put yogurt on there and get our broccoli and paint. You know, if you can just let your imagination run wild, you will come up with creative ways to have fun with food every day. So that's how you introduce a new food. Go through those 35 steps. Take your time. Let your child take the lead. Respect, you know, their signals when they say they're done. But my guess is what I find is when I sit down to have fun with a kid, you know, they're more than willing to experience that food and move to the next stage of our 35 stages or 35 steps to eating.
That's very good. I mean, it makes perfect sense, though, first of all, from the developmental stages that neurotypical kids go through, as you were talking about, and then secondly, the sensory processing concerns that we have with many of these children. So in this way, they're getting, like you say, to smell it, to touch it, to feel it. And I love the kissing it goodbye because that way they're actually maybe going to even get a little taste of it without actually having to eat it. And it's just gently getting them used to it.
And I think that's a good, you know, yeah, gently getting them used to it. And I know sometimes, you know, as a consultant or I'm working with the child and, you know, I'll see a child who surprises me. You know, we're playing, one of the things I like to do is play guess the food. And I'll take a shoebox and put a hole at the bottom and put a food in there and let the kid, especially if they're a little higher functioning so they can talk or, you know, some way to expressively tell me, and I'll put a food in there and have the kid, he's got to feel the food or she's got to feel the food to guess what's in the box. It's the mystery box. And that child will often surprise me, and all of a sudden they'll bring the food out and they'll lick it or they'll take a bite. And so, you know, we have to stay calm in those moments because sometimes we get so excited, or I know I do, it startles the kid. You know, he thinks, oh, what did I do? Just stay calm. It's okay. You know, it's a good thing, but that's fine. Move on. But I know sometimes as parents we get excited. Oh, they tried a new food, and we want to tell grandma, and we want to tell dad, and we want to tell everybody, guess what? So, my son, Justin, tried a new food. The problem with that, again, it puts a lot of pressure back on the kid. So try not to be overzealous. You're going to see gains. But let's not, you know, again, put the stress and anxiety that, oh, if I did it once, do I have to do it again? And do I have to do more the next time? So we're going to try and stay neutral. We're going to be encouraging, but it's going to be those gentle changes because I know I get really excited when I see kids make such great gains.
Good point. Here's, two interesting questions here. I mean, there are a ton of them, but here are different ones from the ones we've been talking about. This is from Anna Tapia in Whittier. My son is overweight due to the fact that the school uses food as a motivator. Please give me some ideas how to help him be more active. He doesn't like to do sports.
Mm.
So what about this whole issue of school using foods as motivators?
Yeah, when it comes to his level of activity, you know, that's something I would want to talk to an OT because maybe it's more motor planning. And some
right.
of our kids have a lot of clumsy, you know, they're just kind of clumsy and have a lot of issues around proprioception. And, you know, I always tell parents, you know, one of the things I like to do is set up an obstacle course in the house. But in the obstacle course, I'll put different foods that you have to feel as you get through the obstacle course. So that would actually meet both of the needs because now he's going to experience new foods as well as movement. You know, obstacle courses are great. They're really motivating to kids. You put a couple of pillows you have to crawl under in a box you have to crawl through in a something you have to crawl over. And you know, it doesn't require a lot of different tools or different equipment in the house. You can get an exercise ball. You have to jump on the ball. And something about an obstacle course kids just seem to enjoy. You set it to music and everybody's ready to have fun. All I do is sometimes I'll just add a station or two of different foods and you have to feel the food and or guess the food. But as far as using food as reinforcement, first of all, I have to say I'm thrilled that the school is using reinforcement because as a behavior analyst, we know that reinforcement is incredibly powerful to change behavior, to help teach our kids new skills. And so, having said that, it is a good thing. But I think the school is stuck with edibles as a reinforcement, and that is a good place to start for a reinforcer. But if the school is not doing an ongoing reinforcement assessment, then you're not going to find out what other toys or activities does this child like, you know, anything from the computer or to race cars or something else, because what we do in terms of applied behavioral analysis, when we know that there's one reinforcer, we need to expand their reinforcement because they're going to satiate on that reinforcement. It's not going to be very powerful to change behavior. And so it sounds like the school is struggling with that. Maybe there's more healthful choices, sugar-free gummy bears. If this is a kid who really is motivated by that edible, I would ask the parent to look into some of the sugar-free. Go to the diabetic aisle in your grocery store, and you can get, you know, little gummy bears, little M&M things that are sugar-free, so maybe we can work on some of the calorie issues. The other thing I would ask mom is, what other things is he reinforced for at home? I mean, does he like music? Does he like books? What is his topic of special interest? Is there something he really enjoys looking at pictures of weather or fire alarms or vacuum cleaners? Or, you know, how can we expand some of that reinforcement? Mom probably is the expert on that. She probably knows what he really enjoys. And she needs to share that with the school and give the school reinforcers because as schools, we don't have a lot of money to buy certain things. And so if there's not a lot of reinforcers for him, it's going to take a team to figure out what reinforcers are possible. I'm glad the school is using them. I wouldn't want them to stop. But we just need to do a reinforcement assessment and look at providing more tangible reinforcers, activity-based reinforcers. And mom might be able to help with that, sending certain things to school that the school might be able to use so that they're not just forced to use food.
I do want to say, though, at home, too, that we have to remember to try and get our kids to experience different things. Because I know, for example, with my son, you know, there's certain things he really likes. You do get in a rut and you forget to have different things available for them to try. And, you know, my son's older now. He's 20. But, you know, over the last few years, we've realized we've been able to find more appropriate things that he really likes, like Qatar magazines. He likes to look at the pictures of the Qatars.
And it would be such a simple reinforcer for the school then.
Exactly, that I would never have thought of before.
Yeah,
and the other thing I say about exercise, because I have a son who's severely impacted by autism, and he's had lots of motor issues. And I just to encourage people when it comes to activity and sports, is that my son is, like, the really hardest person to teach anything physical to. I mean, basically exercise has been mostly walking for him and then swimming, well, he managed to become water safe, but it doesn't look like what we would call swimming. But it's enjoyable and it's some exercise. Now that he's older, he doesn't enjoy it quite as much. But I was amazed that my son actually now can do half an hour on a treadmill and do a whole routine of exercises of machines at a club.
Wow.
And to start at school, the APE teacher suggested it. And it's funny because, you know, you have great people around you, and over the years you learn that each person brings something new. So the APE person suggested this, but she had no idea about ABA and how to motivate my son. But meanwhile, my son had a great tutor who understood the motivational part. So I had, but it was a home tutor. So the home tutor went to school and watched while the APE teacher explained what would be good for Jeremy on the exercise machines. And then this tutor ended up having in his apartment building a gym. So he started taking my son to the gym. And I was thinking, well, you know, he's going to come back after 10 minutes. My goodness, my son really enjoyed it. And then this tutor actually moved into a house with his girlfriend, so there was no more gym. My son now goes to LA Fitness 3 times a week with 2 different tutors, and it's one where the Charger cheerleaders are sometimes. So my son is very motivated to go there as well as the tutors. And so it's really amazing. I just encourage people when they're worried about the sports, really don't put limits on your kids because, you know, I would never have thought that my son could get the motor patterning together, even with the OT that he has, to actually be able to do such a normal activity. And it's brought into this whole social thing now that he really enjoys at the gym because he goes at the same times during the week. So he sees the same people, and it's really opened up another area for him. And I know this is kind of off the food topic, but that sports and the health and the activity is related to all this food issue as well.
Well, but I think also it ties into the fact when you're exercising, you build up a hunger too. So our kids they're not very hungry, they don't seem hungry. Hey, let's get them out there, get them moving. When it goes to the question on digestion and constipation, we know movement helps with that. So, no, again, eating is tied to all the areas, muscle tone, good muscle tone in the body, good muscle tone in the mouth. So, no, I think it's all, again, better health, long-term quality of life, all those issues.
And there have been a few questions in here, and we've talked about a few of them, but that had to do with people concerns that their kids were obese or getting overweight. Well, another classmate of Jeremy's also has started going to the gym, and he's been going actually, through at the school, having access to the exercise room, of course, with the 101 aid under the APE teacher's guidance, and he goes every day. Well, I'm amazed at how much weight this kid has lost, and it's because of the exercising every day.
Oh, that's terrific.
Before
we run out of time, Chantal, you know, I'm glad that we've had an opportunity to have this couple of hours tonight. Hopefully I've given some strategies and to the families out there in terms of just thinking about eating in a different way, maybe you've not thought about before. But I do want to make sure I give a few more references because, you know, you're going to have to educate yourself as parents. It's not like when you and I grew up and, you know, I know I was the president of my Clean My Plate Club, you know, Clean Your Plate Club when you were at home and, you know, or you don't get dessert unless you eat and all the things, all the rules that we were raised with just really are not going to be functional and purposeful for our kids on the spectrum. So I want to make sure there are references available. So families, if you want to check out websites, let me just go through a few that I use on a regular basis. Of course, I mentioned Suzanne Evans-Morris. M-O-R-R-I-S, and her company, New Visions. I think parents will find that website, new-viz.com, to be very helpful in terms of giving them strategies. Ellen Satter's work, again, check out How to Get Your Kids to Eat, but Not Too Much, and Secrets of Feeding a Healthy Family. Her last name, again, is Satter, and you can find her books at Amazon and in a variety of different areas out there. Variety of different companies out there. If you want to check out a food pyramid for children, the USDA has a great website for parents. And not only do they just have the food pyramid, but they actually have activities to learn about foods and, you know, there's a lot of, and it's all free. So I use that website quite a bit. So USDA.gov, and look up parent, you know, resources for teaching your children about food. You know, our tax dollars are paying for all that website, so we might as well use that free information. There's a lot of fun stuff on there. Also, you probably have heard of the Dole Company that makes bananas. Well, they have a program called the Five-A-Day Program. You're supposed to eat five fruits and vegetables. And I like their website because they have free ways to introduce foods, fun ways for typical developing children. But to me, they're something that, you know, parents can do at the house. And so if you check out the Dole Company's Five-A-Day Program, they have an online tips for parents on introducing foods. They have stuff that you can buy, little visuals of different. One thing that I bought from them was a fruit and vegetable bingo. And so it was a fun bingo game, and I've played it with kids. And you know, when they have to actually touch the different foods that they have bingo. And, you know, so check out that because, again, I want to give things that are going to be fun ways to introduce a food every day. The other company that I like is called Talk Tools, T-A-L-K, Talk Tools. They have a lot of eating equipment, like when we were talking about utensils. They have tons of different utensils that you can check out. They have different ways to practice blowing. And when you practice blowing, like blowing a horn or blowing with a straw, what you're working on is that lip closure and the muscles around the lip. And so if you check out their catalog and their website, they provide a lot of education to parents and educators who have children that have eating and oral motor delays. So Talk Tools is a great catalog. And one of the last things I want to leave parents with is a warning about, has your child seen a dentist? Because I've seen several cases over the last few years where the child was having a lot of food issues, but come to find out they had never been to the dentist and had 10 cavities or needed a root canal because they had such bad teeth. And I know kids with autism and Asperger's, going to the dentist is not their favorite thing. And I understand why some of our families out there, it's a struggle to find a good dentist, a good pediatric dentist. But maybe one of the issues that's going along with the chewing, again, it's been in some of the cases that I've seen, it's because there is a lot of dental decay that maybe you don't even see as the parent. I know one of my families within the last year that I've worked with was very surprised that their child had, you know, I think 5 or 6 cavities. And, of course, that's going to impact how well you really want to put different textures and temperatures of food in your mouth. So I just want to give a warning about that. It's certainly something to think about as you are doing a feeding program. And my best advice, of course, is to look at my book and Tanya Segan Hansen, Just Take a Bite. I'm really proud of that book. I know there's people like Bonnie out there who have reviewed that book. If you look at the reviews on Amazon.com, not only parents but professionals in the field have found that book to be very helpful. And so if you're a person, you just can't come up with fun with playing with food, well, there's lots of suggestions in the book, as well as oral motor strategies for parents to try and sensory strategies. So check that book out. It's through Future Horizons. But other than that, I just want to say thanks for everybody for those great questions today. And I want to end with my email in case I didn't get to your question or maybe it's still resonating with you. It might be something you have to think about. But feel free to email me at drlori@cox.net. D-R-L-O-R-I, Dr. Lori, at Cox, C-O-X, .net. And I love to help parents out as much as I can over doing it over email. I can make some generic suggestions. So see if there's specific questions, then I'm always open to answering those to parents and educators.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to remind them one more time of the title of your book. That's Just Take a Bite, Easy, Effective Answers to Food Aversions and Eating Challenges. Now, is that Future Horizons?
It is Future Horizons.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Lori. And I did want to, there were a few people who had emailed some questions and directed to me that had nothing to do with eating. I would love to answer your questions. Please feel free to email me. My email address is sicilekira@mac, that's M-A-C, .com. Thank you so much, Dr. Lori, for all your help in answering the questions. And good night to all our listeners there. Thank you.